is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Before I open up and start with the voice of Colonel Vindman, which we've been doing now for months, and we will continue to do until the election of 2020, of course, it was his testimony, his powerful testimony before the impeachment hearing of 2019. Someone posted something on my Facebook page, and I suddenly realized in part, maybe this is why I do Colonel Vindman every single day. And the question was asked, some of my friends asked why I post so much political stuff on their Facebook page. And then he quoted Eli Wiesel, always take sides. Neutrality helps the oppressor, never the victim. Silence encourages the tormentor, never the tormented. Oof, oof. I love that. I think I want that embroidered on my death pillow, whatever it is. Anyway, now the voice of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Okay, it is Monday. It is our Rethink the Week. Of course, I want to remind everyone our Rethink the Week for Monday is actually Zoomed on Sunday night at 4 o'clock. But, you know, this is the brave new world of, you know, doing media at the time of a pandemic. Joining us are Dean Spiliotis. He is a presidential scholar and a civic scholar from Southern New Hampshire University. He has a blog called nhpoliticalcapital.com. You can hear him regularly on New Hampshire Public Radio on their Friday, their version of Rethink the Week. Joining us from the great state of Texas, Glenn Smith. Glenn Smith ran Ann Richards' first campaign for governor. He works for Progress Texas, and he's a consultant. He's written books. He's prolific, and boy, does he tweet a lot. I'm just telling you. I've been following you, Glenn, on Twitter like crazy. There are so many stories to talk about. But there was a story that I saw just before I came on the air. And it was at the Huffington Post. And you don't need to know it. I just need to read you the headline and the opening sentence. Because I am like, the level of disappointment is, I can't even tell you how shocking. 13 sailors on the USS Theodore Roosevelt again test positive for COVID-19 after reportedly recovering. Oh my God. I see you shaking your head, Glenn. I read it and I got physically sick because at one point I kept thinking, maybe I should get COVID. Therefore, I'll be able to have all these antibodies and then I can help. I can really help. And I think a lot of people who have gone through COVID are hoping that, you know, they can get the antibody test. But this story is just shocking. And they said 8 sailors aboard the aircraft carrier tested positive for the disease after previously testing negative. They had it. Then they were testing negative. Now they're testing positive again. They were, in addition to 5 sailors who tested positive after recording 2 negative tests, meeting rigorous recovery criteria, after being cleared to return to duty, all 13 sailors have been moved off the ship. Glenn, part of the reason I bring this up is that we've got Donald Trump waxing poetic about a vaccine that he says will be there because it's going to be like, it's going to be our missile crisis. We're going to get it. And we're going to have it by December. And he's making stuff up, which is what he's so good at. But even if you didn't believe that there'd be a vaccine, I think there was a bit of hope for all those people who have suffered and all the people that have it that don't even know it, that once we started testing, people would be able to say, I now have the antibodies. I can go back to work. I can help in the hospitals. I can help in the nursing homes. This story is just devastating.
It's one of the things that makes us so unnerving, behind, to say, not to say deadly, and that is we've heard so many stories and so much speculation, so much BS from the White House, to be sure, but also things like you mentioned, like there have been people who hoped that once you had it, you would catch it again, although I think South Korea discovered that maybe you weren't immune after you'd had it once.
Right.
But we don't know. I mean, we hear so many stories about how long it'll take to have a vaccine, what kind of treatments might be in the pipeline. Even the numbers that they give us on testing with the lack of tracing, even those are not reliable. It's like a picture I have in my head is if I was really sick and I was in the examining room and it was full of 10 politicians, 8 spinmeisters, and 2 doctors, and I was expected to extract the truth from what they're saying. And it's not possible. I mean, that's why we're all so worried.
Well, and Dean, I mean, the story of this questionable lack of immunity is somewhat shocking. But at the same time, what I'm hearing from Glenn is that we don't even know whether the testing initially is accurate. Mm-hmm. And supposedly the fast testing that is now happening in the White House has on occasion shown 48% inaccuracy. That's not exactly, that's a 50-50 chance, blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking, do I want that test? Or do I rather go down with the swab and the gag and the whatever? I mean, I'm glad for the instant gratification, but if it's wrong, it's lethal.
Yeah, it's still not clear that people are actually literally getting reinfected. This is a very difficult question to answer at the moment. Glenn mentioned the South Korean example, and for a long time it was being reported out of South Korea that a number of people had tested negative, and then down the road they had tested positive again, and that raised the possibility of low immunity or a lack of immunity. And then at some point after that, they then came back and said, no, they think it was an artifact of the testing. And the problem is that these tests have, as you mentioned, anywhere from 15, the rapid test anyway, has a very high false positive, false negative rate. The other tests, I think, are a little more accurate, but they can take a long time to report. And there's also some research that suggests that people may have this virus in them for many, many weeks, even after they ostensibly recover. And that, it's not being picked up. So we just don't know yet
Let me just clarify something. The reason why the sailors is such an interesting empirical data, which is what we like about it, kind of it's a group that has been totally controlled, okay? Which is it's a real control group, is that they tested negative twice.
Yeah, so, which is unusual, and then to turn positive again, sure.
Exactly, sure. Exactly.
But they're still, this is just a tough question.
Yeah, they're like little test tubes, and the test tube is coming out in a way that is just pretty, pretty frightening. But I wanna talk about the other story that just happened yesterday, which was Saturday, and I don't know if you watched it, but I did go to Barack Obama's graduation for 2020, and I'm gonna start emotionally, and I was like, what is this gonna be? And it was pretty decent. Can I tell you the part that was just unbelievable? It was the opening number, where they sang, I believe it was the Star Spangled Banner, and all the different voices came from all the 50 states. And the young woman who played the piano was breathtaking. But when they got done, I'm gonna cry again. I was in tears. I just thought it was the most magical moment of bringing people together. And I guess when part of the reason why I think this was so powerful was that Donald Trump has worked overtime at dividing us. He has worked overtime at telling the states, you're on your own. He's worked overtime at showing, defending people who don't want to protect their brothers by wearing a mask or social distancing. And this was such a powerful statement. And I felt like it wasn't for those 17 and 18 year olds. I felt like it was powerful because it was important for me. And once again, the contrast between the liar and divider and this guy, Barack Obama, who on occasion disappointed me a lot, I will say that, but there is something incredibly powerful about what he was able to do and what this graduation ceremony was able to do, which was to find the Velcro that makes us proud to be an American.
I completely agree with you. And I had tears in my eyes while I watched the anthem being sung by those kids. I just thought it was beautiful. It was almost perfectly done. And I wanted it to go on. Frankly, if they'd have done it again, I'd have been happy.
Exactly.
You know, and I agree with you about the unity that it showed and the sort of interconnection of all of us in the 50 states and how that is a contrast with a White House that is overtly trying to divide us one from the other, class from class, race from race, state against state. And watch the fight we're about to get in about whether blue states get some more federal aid or not. I mean, everything is divisive. He couldn't divide. I mean, now he's dividing us from between life and death. I mean, divisiveness is his core ethic. And those kids stood up, and I hope one day he has to sit and watch that about 100 times.
Maybe. Maybe when he's in jail. Oh no, he may not go to jail. Anyway, but I mean, I thought it was also powerful. But the other thing that's really interesting for me, Dean, is that this class of 2020 is in a way so different from any other class. They have literally been raised and weaned on social media. They have had a different way and such a different upbringing than my children who are in their 30s, than my friends' kids who are in their late 20s. They really are apart from us. And I used to say as a child, my parents would teach me all the new skills that I would need. Now I have to call my 14-year-old across the street to learn the new skills I need. So in a lot of ways, these kids have been thrown into a situation where they are, in a bizarre way, as much as being molded, but they also are leading because they've had a different relationship and a different understanding of how the future is going to be that's a lot more sophisticated than, frankly, I understand.
Yeah, and I'll say this, you know, I've been teaching college freshmen for 25 years straight, so I've seen this, you know, I've seen this change over a long period of time. And for many years when, you know, you certainly go back to 2007, 2008, the beginning of the iPhone. So we're talking over 10 years ago now. And initially, for a long time, for my students, you know, those who are 19, 20, 21 years old, it was a distraction. It was something that took them away from the reality of what was happening in the classroom, the presentation of the material. Now, it's literally the way that they perceive and process the world through the screen. It's fundamentally, my students today use the phones and understand the world through these phones in a way that is fundamentally different than my students who had phones 8 or 10 years ago. And that's a reality I've had to accept. It's changed how I present information to them. Yeah. It has brought them together. It gives them connectivity with people in their cohort around the world. But it can also be very isolating at the same time. You know, at some level, it's you know, you can have a discussion about replacing, you know, human contact. So, you know, I always tell a story to my students. When I was a college freshman, you know, we would spend hours sitting in the hallway outside our dorm rooms, just kind of shooting the breeze and talking and interacting. They don't really do that now. They do it, but they do it through their phones. Mm-hmm. So it's different now that the pandemic has kind of reinforced that, unfortunately. And hopefully but it's different now.
Right, but think about it. So they've got this interesting social media, and I think Barack Obama kind of mentioned, I mean, they've been through more crises in their short lives than most people. You know, the 2008 economic meltdown. Some of them might have been born, you know, right around the time of 9/11 or right after 9/11. So they heard about 9/11. Then, you know, and then you see this pandemic, and you see all these things happening, and the knowledge of climate change, where we would talk about climate change, Glenn, they are seeing the melting ice caps of climate change. It's not the future for them anymore. It's the present for them anymore. So again, I think they're interesting. But here's my concern. What happens to them if Trump wins again?
Well, I was
that's the part, I mean, because I see him in such a destructive way of anything, and I see the potential for race wars. I see the potential for economic wars. I see the potential for food shortages. I see old people being expendable and being told to die. And I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, what does Donald Trump's next term mean for them? Well, oh my God, Glenn.
Say a couple of things. Well, I don't mean this is going to sound a little flip, but it is true that the most creative period in the history of China was the Warring States period, which gave us Taoism and Confucianism, ultimately led to Chan or Zen Buddhism, and all of that great poetry. I mean, so there is something to be said for the tougher the circumstance, the more creative we are pushed to be, and this young generation may prove to be our most creative. I do, by way of confession, I was talking to my wife last night, I hadn't really thought about this, but we went back to read about the polio epidemic that went on for decades, really. My older sister, 10 years older than me, had polio, recovered. But the vaccine appeared when I was 2 years old. And I got to thinking about, like, my age cohort particularly has had it so damned easy, you know? Like, we had access to all the learning we could ever want and still do. Healthcare, the science advancements, it was like growing up, we never had a care like this. We just assumed it'd be taken care of. I say this by way of confession, which I hope the little bit more difficulties this next generation face will make them much better achievers, much more creative than I have been.
So I mentioned what happens to them if Trump wins again. So I want to look at what Donald Trump is doing by removing anything with the name Inspector General. If the point of this is to be a watchdog, then you must be the enemy. And Dean Scaliotis, I posted this on Facebook. I was thinking about the third surgeon, Inspector General. And now I have an article from the Huffington Post. Nancy Pelosi, Trump's firing of State Department Inspector General could be unlawful. And she goes on to say that, so the top Democrats are looking into this. But one of her points is that it's unlawful to remove a watchdog if it was intended to retaliate against one of his investigations. I wonder which investigation, you know? And so I posted on Facebook, you know, everyone, Donald Trump hates dogs. I believe he's the only president that hasn't had a dog in the White House. He especially hates the breed of dog known as Watch. The only kind of dog that he actually likes, Dean Scaliotis, is the breed known as Lap. And I'm being flip, but it's absolutely unbelievable that these inspector generals, while they're appointed by the president, they're in the executive branch, but they're basically to do oversight of the executive branch, but that the executive branch can then remove them basically at will. At will. So what's the point of having an inspector general that as soon as you start inspecting, you're out of here, bud?
Yeah, well, you know, and I will say his use of dog in a pejorative way always strikes me as very kind of anachronistic. I mean, tens of millions of people are dog lovers. I've had a number of dogs. I have a great dog now. And he just uses it in a very weird kind of negative way that you just don't hear very much anymore. And he doesn't have any pets. So, you know, that's a symptom of his larger issues with empathy and the other. We've talked about that before. This IG stuff is no surprise to me. So Susan Collins said she was troubled.
Well, that's Susan Collins.
Grassley said he was concerned. Romney said he's concerned. What's going to happen? You know, Trump has calculated that he can basically completely ignore oversight, and there's nothing anyone can really do about it other than vote him out of office. And as you heard, that was Obama's one-word answer the other day yesterday to deal with Trump. Is all he said was vote. The oversight is dead in the water right now. I don't, you know, they tried impeaching him. It didn't work. And he knows that there's not much that they can do, believes and is backed up by Barr that he has almost, if not almost unlimited power to do these kinds of things through executive authority. So the oversight function has been suffering for years. And this just kind of feels like the death knell at the moment. Maybe it'll change with a different configuration in Congress. Well, but I just think he figured he doesn't like people who question what he does. And yeah, so he's going to get rid of them, and there's not really much
to do. And I think one of the reasons why it was so easy, Glenn, for him to get rid of him, wasn't it that Pompeo was asking some of his staff to pick up his laundry? Wasn't it that Pompeo was basically saying, you know, pick up my restaurant food? Wasn't it? I mean, so in a lot of ways, it was personal services. And Donald Trump is going, hey, Aren't they supposed to do that? I mean, I hate to break it to you, Glenn. I mean, he's rolling his eyes going, you know, we're in the middle of a pandemic. Pompeo doesn't have time to pick up his laundry. Of course, they should be a Sherpa. I mean, they should be doing this. So to a large extent, it's not only that it's an inspector general, it's a president that basically thinks Bill Barr is his personal attorney, and anyone that's working for Pompeo should basically, you know, go out and get the Chinese. I mean, it's like, as in Chinese food. I mean, it's so within his mindset that everything is personal, and that the staff at the White House is to serve him, not to serve the country.
And it's now matched up with a long-held view of Bill Barr on the unitary executive, right? So yes. That the president whose authority is absolute. He is above all inspector generals. He's above all accountability, right? You can't even investigate him for a crime while he's in the White House, according to arguments from the White House. So those two things converge at the same moment. And I have this question. Somebody that's smarter about contemporary Russian matters than me, doesn't it seem like Trump is following exactly the route that Putin has followed to destroy all potential opposition to his power in Russia? I will grant Putin performed a few more murders over time, but in terms of debilitating bureaucracy and oversight, isn't it just about exactly on track, even in time, what Putin did?
Who do we know that can sort of write that article? I mean, it feels like a parallel track.
It seems so.
I think what's shocking, though, what Glenn said, Dean, is that I think we thought we had more institutional muscle. I think we thought the norms would hold. We always knew that, you know, Russia was new to this change, going from communism to whatever they went to, which was never really a democracy or anything. But we knew that their system was soft and hadn't hardened. But we thought that we were so good at what we did that even a Donald Trump, who would try to sort of dismantle it, could not possibly be successful because there would be some kind of a stop to it. And what we found out is that we're pathetic. I mean, there's not a norm. But of course he also has Fox News and he has a very compliant GOP.
Well, there were two arguments. The first argument was that if he became president, the nature of the institution, the traditions, the kind of standard operating procedures, norms of reciprocity with Congress, that all of that would change and shape him in a way that would be ultimately constraining. And then the alternate argument was that even if he came in and he kind of railed against these constraints, that the institutions were strong enough that others that he put in the bureaucracy around him, cabinet officials, et cetera, would be able to kind of push back sufficiently. And what we realized is that the checks and balances, these institutional constraints, it's funny because I spent a lot of time each year teaching this to students and talking about, you know, James Madison's concerns that you go beyond parchment barriers, that just writing it into the Constitution is not sufficient. You need to structurally design the system to check ambition. And yes, I mean, that's still the case in many respects, but so much of what we saw as kind of norms of behavior really require implicit buy-in from everyone involved.
Exactly.
Even when there are profound policy disagreements, at a basic level, everybody bought into the design of the institutions of government, and Trump just doesn't. And he's basically spent 3 years remaking the executive branch to kind of mirror his family business.
Well, and Glenn, I mean, we all know that everyone serves at the pleasure of the president. And even when there's supposed to be some kind of oversight, like approval by the Senate, what he's figured out is he loves the word temporary. I mean, no, there's no one holds a job. Everyone's like, you know, a holdover or a temporary. So there is no requirement for any kind of Senate oversight. There's no requirement for this. I mean, I got to ask this question. For someone who really never served in Washington, who's giving him guidance on how to do all this crap? I mean, I'm just, because whoever is doing it is actually brilliant. I mean, I want to know where the underbelly is and who's the mastermind. I don't believe it's Stephen Miller, but it could be. But I'm just, because he is masterful at dismantling the executive branch. I mean, masterful. There isn't a button he doesn't push. There isn't a lever he hasn't pulled. There is, it is, and I don't believe it's innate to Donald Trump. I think someone has a roadmap and he is following it.
Well, he was a little bit more ham-fisted before Bill Barr got there, so I'm going to answer your question with Bill Barr. I also have to comment that the phrase you use about people serving at the pleasure of the president, under Trump, that is the stuff of a horror movie to me, right? It's like, oh my God, you're so right. But under Trump, it's like it takes on this aura of just pure horror. Like,
it's not the pleasure of the president. It's the whims of the president.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like he's giving us a whole new vocabulary. All right, we need to go to a break. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude, Rethink the Week. Joining us is Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, Glenn Smith from the great state of Texas, and of course, Ken Barnes is my producer. We'll be right back.
Crayons and clean water, the surprising connection. On this current cast. In Pennsylvania, abandoned coal mines have left a dirty legacy. Thousands of miles of streams polluted by acid mine drainage. Wetlands can be used to treat the water, but in the process, they accumulate a lot of metal sludge that has to be removed, often at great expense.
And so I ended up exploring the idea that this pure sludge might have marketable value.
That's Bob Hedden of Iron Oxide Recovery. He found the rusty-colored material could be used to make pigment for paint and crayons.
If you get a burnt sienna crayon out of your Crayola mix, it is iron oxide for mine drainage.
By turning a liability into an asset, his company makes remediation projects more economically sustainable. Current Cast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. Online at currentcast.org.
Trust me, I don't like you. Sycophant. Typical.
Welcome back to Palin Du of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. It's our Rethink the Week. Again, we have Glenn Smith from Texas, and we have Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University. Ken Barnes is my producer. We've been talking about Bill Barr before the break. So let's continue the conversation, Dean Spiliotis, about the personal hatchet man for President Trump. How does a guy plead guilty? It's like, you know, minutes from going to jail, and suddenly the Department of Justice says, there was nothing there anyway. I'm like, even the judge is like, wait a minute. So this is kind of remarkable because I think what's happening with Flynn is actually part of a bigger puzzle, because we're now hearing Donald Trump trying to change the conversation from the 100,000 deaths, from the lack of testing, from not enough PPEs, from the economy going to hell in a handbasket. Now we're going from getting Flynn off and Obamagate. And I think those stories are actually very connected. And I think that this is part of the fiction that Donald Trump and Bill Barr are trying to create in order to support, look what happened to Flynn. This is part of the administration of Barack Obama and Joe Biden and a number of other people who are out to get Donald Trump. And Flynn is just an example of someone who is in that sort of orbit. And this wasn't real. This was about hurting Trump.
Mm-hmm. Trump loves a good conspiracy theory. And this is a big and complex one. It feeds into his sense of victimhood and grievance that the Obama administration in the waning days of its second term was basically setting him up to fail and eavesdropping and entrapping his rising advisors. And, you know, as you said, it's designed to take certainly the minds of his followers and Fox News off of the pandemic story and to focus on this other story, which has, you know, a fascinating cast of characters. Flynn, all the FBI folks that they've already vilified, Mueller, Comey, the whole crowd of them are going to be brought back to take another bow for the re-election campaign.
Okay, and so you see the Senate bringing everyone back, I think, Glenn, except for Barack Obama. I think everybody else is like fair game, and they're going to sort of bring them in like the conga line of people coming in. They're going to be zoomed in so they can then be interrogated. So here's what I want to know, Glenn. If I were out there, I would do a split screen. Lines of people waiting for food at food banks and Flynn. Lines of people waiting for their unemployment check and then these hearings. Lines of people waiting to, I mean, I'm listening. They think this is a distraction. People are dying, okay? People can't eat. People can't, and if that story is true and you have no immunity or very little immunity, then the idea of even getting it and going back is terrifying because you can get it freaking again. I am looking at this and I'm watching what's happening out there with everybody clamoring about not wearing a mask and social distancing. You and I both know there's going to be an enormous spike. Go for it, boys and girls. Go after Flynn. Have the frickin' hearings because the American people is going to go, and we are expendable for his agenda, which is a distortion of the facts and the truth in order to protect him and have us die.
What could make these habits of the right in America more visible than their attitude towards those who are sick and dying today in America?
Yes.
Which I guess today is the dead, the numbers has gone past 90,000. It was about to, so I assume it has. And if you wondered before why, like, my state wouldn't take expanded Medicare funds or opposed the Affordable Care Act altogether, now you know why. Because these lives were expendable in the first place, so why would they spend any taxpayer money saving them or protecting their health? Because they don't believe it's necessary, even the right thing to do in their moral view. And now they're doing it in a pandemic right before our eyes. Tens of thousands of people are dying. It's hard. It's really hard to believe other human beings, those in control of America today, are actually doing that, but they are actually doing that, you know, and we got to be open-eyed about it and address exactly what's happening.
So Dean, I'm having a conversation with a couple of people about whether the idea of social distancing and wearing masks should not be just a suggestion, that it should be the law, okay? And the reason I say that is we go on a highway and it says 65 miles an hour. And the reason it says 65 miles an hour is not like they want to control your speed, but they kind of want to control your speed. Why? Because they want to keep you safe. And they want to keep the guy on the other lane safe as well. So the reason they do this is that they look at the safety of everyone, the Gestalt, all right? And they decided, I know you want to go 90, but I can stop you and give you a ticket. And if you continue to do this, I can arrest you, okay? When you go through a stop sign, yeah, you didn't want to have to stop at the stop sign, but you know, you might be killed, you might kill someone else. Or when there's a bus with his kids on a school bus and those little red lights come out and start blinking. If you go past, you get stopped by the cops. Why is it done? It is done for health and safety. What do we know about social distancing and about wearing a mask? It is about health and safety. Not only could you get sick, but you could die. Not only could you get sick, but then you bring your illness home. This is even worse than the speeding ticket. Because when I die, I'm dead and I'm on the road. This time, if you give me the illness, I bring the freaking illness home. So it's not even like I get to sort of contain it at that moment. And I think the idea that it's a suggestion is not only a problem, but it's a problem for employers. Because if people say no shirt, no shoes, no mask, no service, they are now finding out that people understood the shirt and the shoes, but for whatever reason, while now they're putting their middle finger up and they're walking in without a mask. And what does an employer do? Because now it puts him in a dubious position of having to be the enforcer because he can't even call the cops.
Yeah, this is just this is a tough issue. I think to some extent the CDC and others in the medical community kind of undercut themselves initially when they, you know, remember when there's initial discussion about masks, there was a real concern that there weren't going to be enough N95 or high quality masks for healthcare providers. So we heard a lot about how, well, you know, we don't really need to wear them so much. It's mainly, we don't want to take them away from healthcare providers. And then the story started to change and, well, maybe it won't stop you from getting infected, but it'll stop you from infecting others. And so I understand all of that. And they seem to have finally gotten onto a one message, but you know, this is just a very difficult thing to enforce. So for example, with your example, you know, speed limits, some people obey the speed limits. Other people don't. For some people, the prospect of a fine is sufficient to compel behavior. Other people see it as a social or a communal good. Some others don't. This is just a very difficult thing to enforce uniformly in our culture.
Safety laws. This isn't in perpetuity, Glenn. This is a temporary condition.
Very difficult to enforce.
And I look, everything is difficult to enforce. I mean, what did Alex Azar say this morning? Okay, the HHS chief was on one of the morning Sunday shows, and he was talking about the distancing guidelines, and he described them as, well, you know, it's part of American freedom. Well, I'm going to use that when I go 90 miles an hour. I want the freedom to go 90. Screw you. You know, oh, what if I kill someone? Well, if I don't wear a mask, what if I kill someone? I'm going to use the mask approach. You know, I mean, at some point in time, it is so American, but the class of 2020, God, I hope they learn from this experience that this idea of freedom doesn't mean you have the freedom to kill me. I'm sorry, Glenn, that's exactly what they're asking. They're making that assumption because they're not just killing themselves. They are now exposing people around me, and they're killing hospital workers, and they're killing frontline workers. And it's just, to me, it is not just a level of selfishness. It is lethal.
You know, I was on Friday night, you may have seen it. We had these really terrible storms sweep across Central and East Texas and on to South. And so we all heard these weather warnings to, guess what? Stay inside. So I thought, where are the protesters telling me those weather warnings are like attacks on freedom, right? Because they're being told not to go out. But somehow or other, it's okay. Look, this has become, as Dean was saying earlier, this has become another like idol in their bag of idols of grievances, right? It's nothing rational about it at all. It is something to complain about. And they're not thinking it through. They don't understand that they could be carriers who are going to make their child or spouse.
I don't believe they don't understand. I think they have decided, I think they know what the storyline is. And I think they've decided that they're believing Trump. They're believing Fox. They're believing they know they're making a choice. And what is so ironic here is normally we're told that if you have a choice and one of them could kill your kid, you want to exercise safety first, then the decision that says who gives a crap. And that's what is unbelievable to me. Both sides don't have a lot of information under their fingertips anyway. I think the scientific community has a hell of a lot more. But even if they still say, well, there's a possibility, but if the possibility is you're killing someone, why are you risking it, Glenn?
I agree completely. And could I just say that, Glenn, you had said it's very difficult to enforce. And I wonder if it really is. I mean, it's certainly impossible to enforce with every human being. But what about selective enforcement? Like, you can't tell the cop when he stops you for going 90 that everybody else is speeding too. It's going 90 also. we can't stop everybody, but we're going to stop some of you. And when you're driving along the highway, Glenn, and you see the blue lights flashing on the side, you know that you're going to slow down too. So why can't the same thing happen in the grocery store? When I was at the meat counter yesterday and the guy didn't have a mask, and I said to him, why don't you put on your mask? And he says, oh, gee, it's too much of a pain. It keeps falling off. Well, I talked to the manager and I said, you got to do something about this. You got to enforce the law.
Yeah, but it's not the law, Dean. It's not the law. It's a suggestion. Chris Sununu is not making it the law. Governor Abbott is not making it the law. People are
I think there are maybe a few cities
order those where people to not go to church.
Right. There's a few places where there are
a few
places,
cities. Yeah.
Right. Well, and look at Michigan. You know, I mean, what you're getting is so much pushback, and you're getting the support of the president on the pushback. I mean, again, if Donald Trump wasn't supporting the people that didn't want to wear masks, the people that didn't want to social distance, we would not have a problem. We would not have a problem. But he's the commander-in-chief, and he basically is suggesting to them that they're taking away your freedom when he doesn't care about their freedom. He cares about the profit and the economy that he thinks he's going to be driving back.
No, it's a useful wedge issue for him. He doesn't want to wear one. He thinks it makes him look less masculine, et cetera. You know, he has the luxury of being tested every single day and all those around him being tested every single day. But even then, as we know, it's not foolproof. Particularly these rapid tests. Yeah, you know, I mean, you could certainly try what Ken is suggesting. I just think it's just very difficult to do.
You could certainly find
some people. But, you know, the police have already, in a number of instances, complained about having to expend a lot of resources on enforcing social distancing. And, you know, if you saw some of the scenes around the country yesterday, it's just thousands of people out and about without masks.
So who was the mayor at the time of 9/11, Glenn, in New York? What was the guy's name?
What's your question? Rudy Giuliani?
Oh, yes. Thank you very much. What is Rudy Giuliani known for? He had his cops go and arrest people that spit on the sidewalk. He had cops go and arrest people that threw paper on the street. What Rudy Giuliani said was, if we deal with the small issues, and we crack down on the small issues, we will suddenly see that the city is safer. And so Rudy, of all people, I would love to run him up and down the flagpole right now, Glenn. Because you know what? If you can be arrested for spitting that doesn't kill anyone, then what the heck can't you be arrested for not wearing a freaking mask? I'm sorry. These conservative Republicans, they have it every which way. And the only reason why Dean was saying you can't do this, and frankly, maybe you can, Glenn, is because we're now fighting the president. It's
crime
not
actually
like
did go down during Rudy's administration.
Pardon me?
Crime actually did go down in New York.
But it went down for a whole lot of reasons other than that. But I just want people to know that he was literally, that was how intense the law was that the cops were stopping you and basically arresting you for the minor infraction.
I'm more with Dean for two reasons. Number one, I think we too easily overlook how much voluntary compliance has to do with following the speed limits. It's not simply fear of getting a ticket or higher insurance rates. People have generally agreed. Compounding that problem this time, as you just alluded to, we have the president of the United States, the leader of America, telling people they don't have to wear masks. So if he's telling people they don't have to wear masks, and you're a city of 4 million people, right, and you're going to try to enforce it, how are you going to do that if the people don't want to do it? Because you can't go get 4 million tickets, right? And these people feel empowered by the president who says you don't have to do it. It would be a different story if the president had led and had said, we're going to have to wear masks for the foreseeable future when we're out in public. We're going to have to social distance. Then it would have been more voluntary, and because it's more voluntary, the numbers would have been easier for us to enforce than they are.
Now the mask is a partisan symbol.
Right.
I mean, that's what's happened. Social distancing now is a partisan symbol. You know, I mean, it's taken on another kind of life, and that is, I think,
it's become shorthand for progressive governmental overreach. You know, this is time-honored critique of the left wing of the Democratic Party, the nanny state. It's the nanny state.
It's the nanny state. And then when I cut you off, the first question I would ask if you go to the hospital, did you wear a mask? Oh, go to the back of the line. Did you wear a mask? Go to the front of the line. Did you social distance? Go to the back. I'm sorry. If I'm going to be triaging, and in the fall, sweetheart, We are going to be triaging because we're going to have two flus, a cocktail of flu. And I am telling you right now, I would beg every doctor and every nurse that it's not first come, first serve. It's not the acuteness. It's how did you behave? Because if you behaved in a way that was intolerant of anyone, that basically wanted to infect everyone, that didn't believe the scientists, well, if you don't believe the scientists, then guess what? I'm a scientist. I'm a doctor. You know what? And this doctor says, if you don't believe me, you go to the back of the line.
There's actually some discussion on there's been some discussion on Twitter about having these protesters in places like Michigan sign a waiver that they won't claim any COVID-related treatment as part of health insurance if they don't wear a mask.
Oh, God. All right. Before we let you guys go, I do have to talk about the fact that we do have another campaign coming up, or in the middle of another campaign, only it doesn't really feel like a campaign. And that is, so Glenn, what does Joe do? I mean, I did see an article that suggests that he's moving more and more to what appears to be the left and getting more progressive. I will admit, I did not watch the MSNBC hour with him and Stacey Abrams. I hope you did, because I didn't. Is he going to be doing this where he's sort of rolling these potential VPs out and sort of displaying them on MSNBC, going, so what'd you think? And I'm kind of curious, number one, what happened with Stacey Abrams? Did she appear to be the stronger candidate of the two? Did she outshine him, which is one of the biggest fears? How did they seem to react together? And do you think this is the approach for him to get some attention and also to build some kind of excitement and momentum as to, you know, who is he going to pick, Glenn?
Well, that's a lot of questions in your question there. I'm not sure where to start.
Start with Joe, and then you can evolve into anything.
Biden has no choice but to move, what you'd say, move to the left. Because I think the profound insight we're getting into what inequality is really costing us in America in terms of health at the moment, just health and death at the moment, it seems to be hitting the poorer people harder. And that's not because they're unhealthy, because they're irresponsible. It's because we have driven them into the ghetto, or forcing them to have shorter lifespans and poorer health care. And so it's a very visible thing. How could the Democratic nominee not move to address that issue? It's fundamental. I also want to say something really quick about this, though. And I said it about the 2008 campaign with Barack Obama and his reelection in 2012. I do not expect Joe Biden to do my work for me. I'm a voter. I've got to win this election. We got a nominee, but he can't do it all. I don't care. I don't care if it's FDR. We have to win this election, right? So I'm not going to ask him to do my work for me or be perfect, because I'm going to hold myself responsible for the outcome.
Well, and I think as I'm listening to Glenn, I totally agree with you, Glenn. I mean, this is not Joe's election, it's mine. I'm just telling you right now. I'm taking this very personally, because I know exactly what I need to accomplish. And what I need to accomplish is au revoir, Donald Trump. You know, and I'll take whatever's there to do it. But at the same time, what will do it is not them, it'll be me. Because I can exercise the franchise. I can actually get myself out there and vote. But as I'm thinking about this, Donald Trump is kind of helping me. And the reason why Donald Trump is helping me is there was a great article at Al Jazeera. Coronavirus and the prospect of mass involuntary euthanasia. The subtitle, the idea that elderly bodies are expendable amid the pandemic has a dark history. And what we are seeing is in the nursing homes around, we're seeing the demographic of who is getting ill. Donald Trump is saying, you know, it doesn't matter, go back to work. We have the lieutenant governor of Texas. Thank you so much. I'm so glad he even said it. He says, I'm 70. I'm expendable for the economy. Yeah, right. I do think that in a lot of ways, Donald Trump is targeting people that actually had been a piece of the base that helped him in beating Hillary Clinton in the Electoral College. And that piece of the base, those elderly, which are, you know, they're sure to vote, they always show up. But the idea that somehow, you know, after all these years of working, and thinking they can finally retire, and basically being told, eh, you know what? I need to make sure the stock market is doing well. You can die now. I really do think that it isn't just that you're seeing Joe Biden moving to the left. I think what's happening is that Donald Trump is showing what he values, and the people that he doesn't value turn out to be voters.
Yeah, you know, I'll say this is going to be, given the circumstances that we're in, combined with some of the challenges that Biden faces as a candidate, and we've talked about those many times on the show. He really has to hope that Trump alienates enough discrete groups of voters that there is this kind of coalition of people who see a like-minded interest in getting him out of office. And you know, there's certainly things that Biden can do on social media with ad buys, with surrogates. If the virus environment changes in August or September, October, maybe he can do some more campaigning. We'll have to wait and see how that develops. But in the end, he has to sort of combine as much of the progressive wing of the party as he can win over with these other disaffected folks that you've mentioned, some of whom voted for Trump, others who maybe voted third party last time, and just try to piece together a coalition. And as, you know, use President Obama to the extent that President Obama is willing to
President Obama is going to be his surrogate. President Obama is going to be his surrogate. But you know what? That's the reason why they're going to start holding hearings in the Senate with Lindsey Graham, Glenn, because they want to make sure that they taint Barack Obama. This isn't about a distraction, really, from COVID. It's about making Obama a little bit nervous about going out in public. It's about making Joe Biden a little bit leery about bringing in some of those other people that can act as surrogates. I think the whole rationale for what they're doing with Flynn and these series of hearings is that they're trying to somehow taint Barack Obama. And since the Senate is controlled by the Republicans, they're going to be pretty effective at being able to pull out some kernels of truth. The whole picture may not say anything about Barack, but there may be enough pieces in there that between what Lindsey Graham can do and what Fox News can do and our liar-in-chief can do, I think what they're trying to do is shut Obama down.
They won't succeed with that. It's a ridiculous strategy if that's really what they're trying to do. I'm afraid it has more to do with race than anything else. They're just going to show themselves attacking the black president one more time in public and hope it helps fire up their white base. That's what I think.
Wow. Do you think that's a strategy, Dean? Do you think it's the color war?
I certainly think they're going to try to create as much doubt. And a lot of this is really almost just kind of like churn. It's churn for the Trump faithful to keep them on edge and to keep them motivated, because if they get dispirited and don't turn out to vote, they're going to try to convince his supporters that, that the Obama administration was corrupt and that this is essentially a restoration of Obama. You know, I've already heard a number of different individuals talking about Joe Biden, Hunter Biden, and China and investment banking, and talking about some meeting in January where they don't really know whether or not Obama knew what was going on, but maybe he did, maybe he didn't. It's just this constant churn of sowing seeds of doubt, and also, it's just a way to keep his supporters whipped up and to potentially depress turnout on the other side. So.
So, Glenn, I want to end with this. Nancy Pelosi has come out with this huge, huge bill. The biggest bill ever, giving money to cities and towns and states and hospitals and more workers. And it's just an incredible bill. And, of course, what we're told from McConnell and what we're told from the president, it's dead on arrival. So was she right in doing this? Is that her split screen? They're holding hearings about Russiagate or Obamagate or Flynn or whatever. And then she can say, how's your property taxes doing? Are they going up because we didn't help you with the state and local government? How are your services doing? Everything that's in the bill, she can then point to Texas. She can point to Montana and say, here's how we wanted to help. Look what they're doing and look what we're doing.
Well, she was absolutely right to do it. And I'll tell you one reason why. And once again, I think even the McConnell-Trump axis is being short-sighted, because urban areas and the states are what drives the U.S. economy. And if you short them of the money to get through this, you're going to hurt the economy even worse than it might already be hurt. And yeah. So you're cutting off their nose to spite their face, and they're trying to make it a political decision. But what they're forgetting is the lost tax revenue in the cities in Texas is enormous. The lost tax revenue for the state is enormous. If you leave them to try to solve this on their own, they can't borrow the way the federal government can borrow. They only have one choice: to cut police and fire and transportation and healthcare, or to raise taxes. The federal government doesn't have that issue. They can borrow the money and give it to the states and local governments to get us out of this mess. And they're not thinking straight if they want to make it a political issue, because it'll be their hammer that hammers the economy one more time.
Well, and let me just say one other thing. I was reading an article about how many oil and gas workers have lost their job. And I'm going, bingo, 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 Texas. And these are guys that get paid a lot. They get paid well. So not only have they lost their job, but for the first time now, they have an experience that they haven't had, because you usually have a benefit package. And that is the cost of COBRA. Okay? So you've got people who were well compensated in an industry that right now is just hemorrhaging. They're losing their jobs, and they really had, it's been a long time since they've lost their jobs in that industry. You know, things have gotten pretty stable for oil and gas. And I think the failure to expand Medicaid, the cost of COBRA, suddenly realizing that you're not getting state and local government support, which means that your property taxes are going up even as you have no job, and you're going to have to pay for COBRA, and you have to pay for food. I think that in a place like Texas, it could go blue if Donald Trump keeps this up. Because people that never thought it would happen to them, it's not the pandemic, it's the economics that is happening to them. And they have to be terrified, Glenn.
Well, except, of course, that in addition to what Glenn's talking about with how their policies are really going to hurt urban areas and undermine their ability to survive financially, the Republican strategy is a pincer movement, the other part of which is to disenfranchise urban areas and the minority people who live in them.
Right. Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, Glenn, am I right? I mean, what's happening with oil and gas workers in Texas must be a shock to the system, both from a revenue perspective. But these are people that were incredibly comfortable having what they thought would never be taken away. And now it's not just the pandemic that's caused this. So it's so interesting how they're experiencing sort of a double slam.
No, I'm glad you mentioned it. It's absolutely true. The last time there was anything like this was the mid-80s here, and oil took a dive. And right. You know, the freeways of Houston were empty. This is far worse than that. Because these job losses might well be permanent, at least in terms of 10 or 20 more years. They could really be permanent. But what are these people going to do? They have been drivers of the economy in Texas, just in terms of their own family spending, right?
If people
come in and help, what do you expect will happen to the economy here? That's what I can't get.
And I need to let all of you go. This is a great conversation. Glenn Smith, we're so glad we found you in Texas. Dean Spiliotis, I've known you forever. Southern New Hampshire University. Ken Barnes, thank you for producing the show. This is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. We'll talk tomorrow. Ciao.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.